funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who was Barack Obama's mother, and how did her dreams, demands, and disappointments shape her life and that of her now famous son? When 17-year-old Stanley Ann Dunham started her freshman year of college at the University of Hawaii, she'd never even had a real boyfriend. By the end of that first semester, she was pregnant by a Kenyan student 5 years her senior, whom she married soon after her birthday. But while campaign rhetoric often simply described Dunham as a white woman from Kansas, my guest today has explored her life and career on its own merits and found a fascinating person with big dreams for both herself and her two children, one of whom would go on to live in the White House. Janie Scott spent 14 years as a reporter for the New York Times before going on leave to write her new book, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Janie, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
So if white woman from Kansas is like an unforgivably simplistic way to describe Stanley Ann Dunham, is there a one-sentence definition that even begins to sum up her life?
I think actually one of the interesting things about her is how difficult she is to categorize. This is a very complicated life. I'd say if there's a single word, it would be unconventional. But no, I mean, here's a woman who over and over again made rather unusual, some would say brave, some would say foolhardy choices, and lived, managed to make adjustments for whatever mistakes she made, go on and leave a trail of remarkable accomplishment in areas like anthropology, international development, microfinance, and produce the first multiracial president of the United States.
So she ultimately would earn her PhD. Both of her children would go on to get advanced degrees. Education was a long-valued family tradition for her.
That's right. I was really interested to discover the history in their family, in the president's mother's family, of a real commitment, serious commitment to education. Going back many generations in Kansas, they were school teachers and educators. Her parents did not complete college, but they were really an aberration in their families. All of their siblings went to college. Three of the four of them went on to graduate school. Two ended up with PhDs. And I found that even back in the Oklahoma Territory, there was a branch of the family which was sending every son to college.
Was Obama's mother, in fact, the first presidential mother with a career, a significant career in her own right?
That's a good question, and I haven't done a full study of presidential mothers, much as I've been tempted to, because so many questions like that came up in my mind in the couple of years I was working on this. But I think it must be safe to say that there's no presidential mother who has such an extraordinary breadth of professional accomplishment, high level of education, and a kind of global life like she did.
She was her parents' only child, and they moved around a lot when she was growing up.
Yeah, I think that really shaped her in many ways. Her parents, while we would imagine that this couple from small-town Kansas who grew up during the Depression might be relatively traditional, actually turned out to be rather unconventional themselves. Her mother, Madeline Payne, married at 17 in secret during her senior year in high school because her parents didn't like the guy she wanted to marry, Stanley Dunham. And when she graduated from high school, they immediately, you know, announced that they were already married and headed for California. So they got out of Kansas very fast. They did return during the war when Stanley joined the Army, and their daughter, who was called Stanley Ann but became Ann as an adult, was born in 1942. And the family moved really constantly throughout her childhood from Kansas back to California, back to Kansas, to Oklahoma, to Texas, to Seattle, and then to Mercer Island, Washington, and finally to Hawaii when she was 17. Her father was a furniture salesman, I don't think particularly successful, and also had a kind of wanderlust and was just pursuing another job and a better life. But as a result, Anne grew up in sort of constant motion and always something of the outsider in the communities that they landed in, having to, you know, reintroduce herself with this funny name, Stanley Ann. And she developed, apparently early on, a rather wry outsider sensibility, kind of observing, the participant observer in the communities in which she found herself, which is strikingly like the posture called upon, you're called for in an anthropologist, which, of course, is the profession she finally went into.
Mm-hmm. And yet, when she was an anthropologist, she did her best to really drink in the culture and not, at least to the people she was working with, stand as an outsider.
That's right. I think that the as it was explained to me by other anthropologists, the sort of ethic of the kind of work that she did is that of coming in as an outsider and allowing that the people that you are studying to sort of socialize you to their ways. Mm. So you are always from somewhere else, and yet you come to understand them by really getting inside their world, their culture, their values. So I think she turned out to be very good at that. She wasn't, as a child, you know, she tended to be something of a nonconformist in that she didn't seem to feel compelled to try to conform to, say, adolescent norms in Mercer Island, Washington. She wasn't an outright rebel, but she could be counted on to make her own decisions and didn't particularly kowtow to the local, you know, tastes and the things that kids were supposed to wear and all that in the school that she went to. And I think that is a little bit like the way she was in her many, many years of working in Java. She spent more than half of her adult life there, either doing anthropology or doing things related to anthropology. And apparently what characterized her was not that she became one of them or that she ceased to be American, but that she had, she was still, as one of her colleagues said, one of us, but with an enormous appreciation of the world that she was observing and working in.
So, ironically, the reason she didn't go back to the mainland for college after her family had moved to Hawaii was that her dad thought she was too young to go off on her own to go to college. So she stays very close to home and then gets pregnant within, what, 2 or 3 months?
Yeah, I don't think it was what Stanley Dunham had planned. he was very protective and rather controlling, and there was some considerable tension between them over this as a quality in her childhood and adolescence. And then he did require that she move to Honolulu upon graduation from Mercer Island High School in Washington so that she could go to the University of Hawaii and be a little bit under his thumb. She had wanted to stay in Seattle and go to the University of Washington or maybe even go to the University of Chicago. That wasn't possible. But very quickly, within weeks of arriving in Honolulu in the summer of 1960 and early fall, within weeks of enrolling at the University of Hawaii, she fell into a relationship with Barack Obama, the first African student at the University of Hawaii, and was pregnant by early November.
What was the social and academic climate like at the University of Hawaii in the early 60s?
It was an interesting moment in the history of the University of Hawaii. It traditionally was a sort of quiet, slightly sleepy land-grant institution in a rather beautiful location. I noticed in looking at the several years' worth of college newspaper, the student newspaper, that up until that time there was a lot of preoccupation with beauty pageants, sort of multi-ethnic beauty pageants and dances and those sorts of social events. It was extremely diverse, as the state was, no racial majority either in the state or at the university. But in the early 60s, the most interesting thing that began to happen on that campus was it came from the development of something called the East-West Center, which was a federally funded institute for sort of cultural and technical exchange between East and West that came to be situated at the University of Hawaii. And they brought many Asian students from all over Asia and South Asia to Honolulu to study and then to be dispatched throughout the United States for travel and further educational exposure. At the same time, many of the students from American students at the East-West Center went off to Asia. And on the campus, the growing foreign student population, the change in the curriculum because of this, the influx of federal money, made that the most sort of vibrant part of that campus at that time. So she arrived at a time of enormous interest in foreign students. Barack Obama had actually antedated the East-West Center. He had come separately through a different program. But after her marriage to him imploded rather abruptly after the birth of their child. She then met an Indonesian student who was a graduate student at the East-West Center named Lolo Sutoro, who became her second husband.
In hindsight, Jenny, given the controversy over the birth certificate and all that, would it have hurt Barack Obama's chances to be elected president had his parents not married even for less than a year, which is, I guess, the time they spent together? Had he been born out of wedlock, is my question.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not sure I understand American views on that. I mean, it's clear that American views are subject to some flexibility because Americans did elect the first so-called, you know, the first black president or multiracial president. But I don't know whether, had he been born out of wedlock, it would have been a factor. I just don't know.
So it is really impressive, particularly given the time. So you have now a newly single mother with a biracial child, not only raising this child on her own, but making the decision to complete her education. What did it take for Ann Dunham to do that with a very young child in tow?
I think it took a certain amount of support from her parents, mm-hmm. which is interesting. That began a pattern that was sustained throughout the rest of her life. She died before her mother died, but after her father. But they continued to help her in many ways, financially subsidizing the education of her children at times, filling in when she was away, having Barack lived with his grandparents during high school. So a large part of that, I think, was an enormous amount of support from this couple of Kansans. And then I think you sort of have to look at the place and the period. I think she was perhaps subjected to a little less critical judgment and perhaps prejudice because she was doing this in Hawaii. And the university was very aggressively courting students at that time, so the tuition was extremely low, something like $85 a semester. She did work in a paid campus job in order to help pay for her expenses while she was as an undergraduate. And she also told a friend in Indonesia later that she used to take Barack to class in a stroller.
I have to say, there are pictures in the book, and he was an exceptionally cute little baby.
He certainly was. Yeah, one of my favorites is the one of him dressed up as a pirate, yeah. With her looking about 14 in that picture, kneeling behind him in shorts with her hair pulled back in a headband and her arms around him.
Yeah, more like a babysitter than his mom.
Yes, exactly.
But she wasn't going out to party and leaving the baby with her parents. And it's important to sort of let people know that because some people have this vision of her as someone who was not that into being a mother.
Yes, people, I think, particularly Americans possibly, hold it against her that she made some really unorthodox parenting decisions, taking her son abroad to Indonesia at 6, sending him back by himself at 10, then leaving him with her parents for high school. Many Americans can't wrap their heads around this kind of behavior in a mother. What I found was this was a person who was juggling a variety of considerations that are far more complicated than we've traditionally given her credit for, and whether or not we would arrive at the same conclusion, when you consider what those factors were, her decisions are more understandable. She, as we were discussing, cared deeply about education. It was in the history of their family, it was an important value, and she found herself in Indonesia with a very bright 10-year-old child in whom she had enormous confidence. She always believed that he was destined for something great, and she was faced with the choice of how to educate him in a place where there was no good English language education.
My guest is former New York Times reporter Jenny Scott. Her new book is called A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Janie Scott. She formerly reported for the New York Times and then took a leave to write her new book, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So Janie, Ann Dunham also met her second husband at the University of Hawaii, Lolo Satoru. He was Indonesian. Was she already interested in Indonesia as a focus of her anthropological studies, and therefore that cemented their relationship, or did her interest in living and working there come from her relationship with Satoru?
That's an interesting question. I do not have any evidence that she was particularly interested in Indonesia before she met him. She told her daughter Maya, their daughter Maya, that she, there at least was a one version of the story, was that she met him at the tennis courts and that he looked particularly great in his white tennis shorts. He was a very good tennis player and very affable, amiable guy who was sort of the polar opposite, I think, temperamentally and perhaps intellectually from the very charismatic, rather overbearing Barack Obama. So she began seeing him. There's a wonderful photograph that someone showed me of them at Indonesia Night at the East-West Center in 1963, in which she's dressed in traditional Javanese outfit, standing with Lolo and several other and another Indonesian student. So I think it was more that he got her interested in Indonesia.
But then when he was called back to there was a very serious conflict taking place there in the early 60s. When he was called back to do military service, a year later she went and joined him and with Barack, who was then called Barry. He seemed to her to be a changed person.
Yeah, when he was at the University of Hawaii, he was outside of his own culture, away from family expectations, away from the complex politics of Indonesia in that period. And he was, as many foreign students were, free to behave in a different way than he did at home. But as you point out, there was an attempted coup and counter-coup in Indonesia in September of 1965. And at that time, in the aftermath, when there was enormous amount of political and social upheaval in the country and the slaughter of many Indonesians, he and all foreign students during that period were called back to Jakarta. So he had to go back early, and he was, as a result of his agreement with the government having to do with his being allowed to study abroad, he was expected to put in 4 years of government service. So he went into the army. So all of a sudden he was conscripted into the army, sent off to help map the border of what is now Papua New Guinea. He was back in the bosom of his large, extended Javanese family with their own expectations of how he should be behaving. And there were also cultural expectations. So she returns, she comes to Indonesia, having never been there before, with her six-year-old son to join the man that she had married and not seen in a year. And she's confronted with a person who is somewhat withdrawn, quieter, sort of feeling, she concluded, kind of beaten down by all these pressures and expectations. And I think it really took a toll on their relationship at a critical moment.
How much of a role, a parental role, did Lolo Satoru play in Barack Obama's life?
The main source I have on that is the president's own account in Dreams from My Father, his memoir, but also some of Lolo's relatives who spoke to me in Jakarta. And I think Lolo really embraced him as a son. I was told by many people in Indonesia that the Javanese subscribe to a sort of it-takes-a-village approach to child-rearing, and they love children and are quite willing to sort of take charge of other people's children and you know, help out. And I think in that spirit, he was something of a father figure for Barack Obama at a critical juncture in his life, ages 6 to 10.
None of that spared young Barack Obama from racial teasing that was pretty ruthless, it sounds like, even from his classmates, but also even from some adults in his life.
Yeah, people say, both Indonesians and Westerners who've lived there, that Indonesia is a very race and color-conscious society, despite its extraordinary diversity, and that there were very few people of African descent living in Jakarta at that time. There's also, interestingly, in Java, a real ethic of self-control and not letting on that, teasing or whatever kind of taunting you might experience gets to you. So from stories that were told to me, I understand that the young Barack Obama was teased about his skin color, perhaps about hair texture and body type. And there's an amazing story that, one Western woman told me who had met Ann Dunham and the young Barry Obama in 1971 at a lunch in Yogyakarta, and afterward they went out for a walk, and some Indonesian kids started throwing stones at young Barry and taunting him with racial epithets, and he just sort of laughed it off and jumped around, as this woman said, as though playing dodgeball with unseen players. And his mother, to this woman's amazement, didn't react. And when the woman offered to intervene, thinking that Anne didn't understand what was being said, Anne said, no, that's fine, he's used to it. So I do think he experienced that, and I think also from that, as well as just a general approach to raising children in Java, he learned a kind of self-control that we see a lot of evidence of even today in him.
So during this time, she is still very committed to her career, as she remains throughout her life, whereas her husband really had expected her to be a sort of typical expat wife and show up with him once he was working for an oil company to these fancy dinners and sort of sit around and complain about the servants and talk about their kids.
Right. I think that was one of a number of sources of tension in the relationship. He, as has been observed, became in some ways more Western, and she became in some ways more Javanese. And when he expected her to dress up in the proper garb and go to the petroleum club to fraternize with the other oil industry wives, she put her foot down and refused to do it. There's an interesting scene in Dreams from My Father in which the president describes hearing the voices rising in the next room as his mother and stepfather argue about this.
And during this time, she's working. She has servants to sort of help with taking care of Barry. And then she had a newborn baby as well, Maya, who was born in 1970, 71?
That's right, 70.
Yeah. But was she around a lot during the evenings? And, you know, how significant was her role as mother during this time in Barack Obama's life?
Well, I know that the job that she took in 1970, and she was really working at this point, according to her friends, to both make money because, at least initially, Lolo was making very little money in the Army, although he started to make more at the, in the oil company job, as well as to figure out what she wanted to do with her life. But she got a job in early 1970 setting up the business communications department, the English language business communications department of a management school that had been formed some years earlier by a Jesuit priest, a Dutch Jesuit, in order to create a sort of Indonesian elite in this post-colonial period. And she, the classes were in the late afternoon and evening. So my sense is that she was teaching and managing this school sometimes, certainly a little bit later in the evening, and that perhaps she was a bit more free in the daytime than you would have expected. But yes, they did have servants, which I think was very common among people that we would consider to be sort of middle-class Indonesians. They did not live in the lap of luxury, and they were not particularly wealthy, but they had enough money to have three or four servants. It's interesting to think about that Anne was able to have a kind of life in Indonesia, and this went on for years, that she really could not have had in the United States, which made it possible in some ways to be a working, eventually single mother in a way that would have been much harder at home.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Adan on the line in Dallas. Hi, Adan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, why are the accomplishments by Barack Obama's mother taken so lightly or just completely dismissed by the American media and the population in general, United States in general?
I think it's complicated. You know, the way he originally wrote his life story or told it sort of arose out of his election as the first black president of the Harvard Law Review. When he was elected in 1990 to the Harvard Law Review, a series of newspaper articles about him were written. And this is where you see the beginning of the sort of telling of the story of Barack Obama's life. And whether it was the preferences of the reporters and the kinds of questions they asked or the type of information they chose to put into the story, or whether it was the way Barack Obama told the story of his life, the focus became more and more on his father. And you see in those articles, some of which are quite long, that his mother is often referred to as simply a white woman from Wichita or an anthropologist working in Java, but there's very little detail about her. And this is at the height of her career. And that, as a result of those articles, he was invited, encouraged by a literary agent, to write a memoir, Dreams from My Father. And so that book, really, I think, because of the way it arose out of his election as the first black president of the Harvard Law Review, became about his black identity, the sort of black part of his past, and the search for how he fit in and who his father was. And that kind of set the template, I think. And so when he becomes more well-known and tells his story at the Democratic Convention and then in the campaign, both through the way the media characterized it and perhaps to some extent the way he did, we end up hearing almost nothing about her. And she's reduced to a series of oversimplifications, you know, not just the white woman from Kansas, but the single mother on food stamps or the cancer victim who died young while fighting with her insurance company. I think, to give everyone the benefit of the doubt, her story is complicated and contradictory and not easily reduced to a thumbnail sketch. But I'm sure there are other possible explanations one could give as well.
I know that you interviewed the president exclusively, and you also spoke at length with his sister, and it's clear that they both loved and respected their mother. Do you have the sense, though, that he used her, and she had already died by the time he ran, certainly for national office, but even she was dying around the time that he was first running for state senate in Illinois. Do you have the sense that he used and manipulated her image for political benefit?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we don't know much about the mothers of most candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we knew a little bit about John McCain's mother because she was, in her 90s and remarkably hale and showed up on the campaign trail. But we don't really know a lot about candidates' mothers. I do think that, and this is a point that people made to me and has been written before, that then Senator Obama was dealing with the problem that many Americans viewed him as different and exotic, not just for racial reasons, but he'd spent this time in Indonesia. He'd grown up in Hawaii, a state that many Americans don't understand and haven't been to. And so he had to wrestle with that while appealing to the broad spectrum of American voters. And as someone pointed out to me, and this is in the book, he's running for president in the United States of America. It doesn't help him to say my mother was in some ways more Indonesian than American.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
I think to emphasize the things that she had in common with other Americans rather than the things that made her different probably came naturally both to him and to his campaign strategist.
So Ann Dunham was famously very passionate that her children get the best possible education they could receive, and she made a lot of unorthodox choices in order to ensure that. She also raised, mostly as a single mother, two biracial children. We know that she was very tolerant on questions of race. Did she have a particular skill set to help them deal with the realities of the rest of the world not being quite so tolerant?
It's interesting. They often refer to her as a little bit naive, and I think, which is not a characterization that I encountered from almost anyone else who knew her. But their perspective is obviously unique, and I certainly don't dismiss it.
Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps some of that came from that question that you're asking. Maya, I believe it was, said to me at one point that it was almost a little bit like, can't we all just get along? A sort of, which implies to me, with its echo of Rodney King, implies to me perhaps a too rosy assumption about how far Americans are willing to move from their traditional prejudices. So I get a little bit of the sense that Anne, because she herself felt not particularly influenced by the race or ethnicity of the people that she was dealing with or even falling in love with, that she sort of assumed, why can't other people do the same thing? And so I don't know that there was a lot of, rigorous preparation for a world that was perhaps less enlightened than she was, although she did make a very clear effort to expose her children to the cultures that they came from. She, famously encouraged young Barack to learn all about recent Kenyan history when his father was coming for a visit when he was 10. She, exposed him to African-American history and music, and certainly with Maya, who was half Indonesian, she lived with her in Indonesia for many years. So I think she, maybe you could call it the sort of prerogative of the person, the white-skinned person who's not experiencing discrimination, to say, we can just ignore it and move beyond it.
How did she feel about the young adult Barack Obama's decision to identify largely as a Black American?
I think there was, over the years, because of some of the choices she made, more distance between Anne and her son than she was sometimes comfortable with. She had, sent him back to Hawaii for his education. He had then chosen to stay there during his high school years. So for a significant number of years in his adolescence, they were not together. And it's clear from her friends that this was a very hard thing for her to do, and something that from time to time she felt a little panicked about. So then you get to the point where he is out of law school and he goes back to Chicago and immerses himself in the world of Chicago, becomes interested in Chicago politics, and increasingly self-identifies as an African American, and necessarily, immerses himself in, among other things, the African American community in Chicago. And a friend of hers and a colleague in Indonesia in the early 90s, who knew her very well, worked closely with her, traveled in Indonesia with her, and lived in a house that she and a couple other people lived in, told me that she had a sort of wistful sense that he was putting distance between himself and her, not a sense of rejection, but just a feeling that he was making a professional choice to identify in that way that was not really part of what she knew he'd had as a child.
Jenny Scott is my guest. Her new book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. We'll be back in a minute, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Former New York Times reporter Jenny Scott is my guest. Her new book is called A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Jenny, how did Ann Dunham's fieldwork lead her into what we now call microfinance that didn't even really have a term at the time that she got involved with the movement?
Well, she had always been interested in handicrafts, even as a child. Apparently, she, for a time, had a loom and wove for a hobby. So she arrived in Indonesia at a time when handicraft industries, really because of the poverty in the country in that period, were experiencing something of a resurgence. There was these are industries that, unlike in a lot of developing countries, still were producing objects for daily use, like agricultural tools and cooking tools and clothing, textiles, batik, just for everyday clothing, leather puppets used in entertainment. And the country had an enormous amount of this, and it seemed to be on the increase, actually, because of changes in agriculture and the Green Revolution, and women in particular were moving out of agriculture and increasingly going into these handicraft industries. And so she was just interested in them naturally. Then she got interested in the people, and so then when she finished her graduate coursework, she decided to do her dissertation on the role of these cottage industries as a sort of subsistence survival scheme for rural families. So she did extensive field work in small villages, ending up focusing particularly on what's known as peasant blacksmithing, which is the making of agricultural tools and other iron and low-grade steel equipment, including gongs for gamelan orchestras. And in the course of working on this, she discovered that the potential for these industries to grow was limited largely by a lack of access, in her opinion, to capital. If you wanted to invest more money in your little business, you had to borrow from, in effect, moneylenders or loan sharks at exorbitant rates. And she realized that if capital were more available, particularly to women entrepreneurs, they could expand these and poverty, at least in those small communities and in those families, could be alleviated. So she also happened to have developed a skill, just being very good at talking to these people, that was of great demand in international development at the time. The United States Agency for International Development in that period started hiring a lot of anthropologists to try to help them better understand the communities and countries they were trying to serve. So she started working mainly to make money to support herself and her children and her children's education. She started taking these consulting contracts in international development, and more and more her work there ends up focusing on setting up microcredit programs, small lending programs, lending money, you know, the equivalent of $10 to $50 to these people who otherwise would be borrowing from loan sharks. Now, she didn't come up with this idea. It was in practice in Indonesia at that time and being tried out by a lot of different non-governmental organizations and development groups, but she was really in on the ground level. Then she, in the late 80s, she ends up being hired by one of the largest commercial, government-run commercial banks in Indonesia as sort of the anthropologist on staff, going out and doing kind of consumer research to figure out how better to fine-tune their own microfinance program, which was doing both lending and small savings accounts, and at the time was the largest self-sustaining commercial microfinance program in the world.
The president has described his mother as being a rather disorganized person. Is that why it took her so very long to finish her dissertation?
Well, he does suggest that, and he, I mean, I think she probably was quite disorganized in a number of ways, and he certainly would know. But I think there were other factors in why it took her so long to finish her dissertation. This is not an uncommon phenomenon among graduate students, I'm told, especially those who have children and families, that you just there have been times recently where it's the average period from entering graduate school to completing your dissertation has extended to something like 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
So people, they need to support themselves, so they get drawn off doing jobs, and sometimes, like Anne, they find jobs that actually are interesting to them, which is both a blessing and a curse, because they're making the money that they need to keep going with their education, but they're also doing something sufficiently interesting that they get sort of drawn away from the dissertation. I think she had a sort of incredibly omnivorous curiosity that drew her from one industry to another to another to another, and the amount of research she ended up doing over what became a 15-year period is just extraordinary. So I think it's a combination of disorganization and the stresses of being a single working parent trying to get your own PhD while also educate your children.
It seems like reading the book that she gave her children what she thought to be, you know, the best possible life given the circumstances, and they had this interesting life and they were living in these interesting places. But then, you know, it's sort of stark looking at the choices that Barack Obama has made for his own life. I mean, granted, he's in the White House now, but even before then, you know, he has a very traditional marriage and two children and a very different sort of life for himself that he chose.
I interviewed him in the White House last summer, and he spoke very directly about that. He said that while his mother's example and her values informed his decision to go into public service, he had made a very conscious choice not to embrace her expatriate kind of global citizen life. He said that for him, that kind of a life bespoke a certain lack of commitment and a sort of perpetual observer, outsider's posture. And he just didn't want that. He said it was not a rejection. It was just what made him an assessment of in what kinds of situation he was comfortable or not. So he said he made a really clear choice to root himself in Chicago, marry a woman from Chicago, and create as a primary value in their lives a stable base for his children of a sort that he had not had.
What did Ann Dunham think of Michelle Robinson, now Michelle Obama?
I only have a few glimpses of that, but she first met her on a Christmas visit to Hawaii in the early 90s, I believe, when Barack brought her out there on his their break, I think, from law school. And she wrote to a friend in Indonesia that she that Barack had brought this new girlfriend, that she was she had, you know, impressive academic credentials. She was tall. I can't remember the exact wording, but something to the effect of attractive but not beautiful, but nice, and that she would not be unhappy if he decided to settle down with her. She also, though, confided to, I can't remember if it was that friend or another friend, that she was struck by the fact that Michelle Robinson's range of experience was much narrower. She had a much more parochial background than Anne had really worked hard to give her children. She wanted her children to have a kind of global perspective. And here was a person who had really grown up in one place, gone away to wonderful colleges and universities, but then gone back to that place and, you know, was deeply rooted in one part of the United States. So I think she had to sort of wrap her head around that idea.
Did she ask him to come back and be with her when she was dying?
Not that I've ever heard. She was not inclined to put those kinds of demands on her children. I think she raised her children to be independent and brave and go out and do good things. That was an important part of her values and impressed upon them very early. And I think when she became ill, she, for a long time, refused to even accept that she was dying. She, according to those who saw her during that period, you know, didn't talk much about her illness. Really, and I've seen correspondence in which she writes, you know, even months before she dies, that she intends to go back abroad and work on a series of consulting contracts so that she can still be getting her medical care. So I think she, for a long time, really didn't think it was going to kill her. And then by the time it did, by the time it became apparent that she was going to die of cancer, he was deeply immersed in multiple things in his life. His book, his first book had just come out. He had just announced that he was going to be running for political office for the first time, and he was teaching at the University of Chicago and working in a law firm. So he saw her in September. She died that November in New York when she went to get a second opinion at Sloan Kettering, and then he didn't see her again. According to him, he was in constant communication with her by phone up until a couple days before she died when she lost consciousness, but he was not there when she died. A decision, if I don't know if it was a decision, a fact, he said he regrets more than almost anything in his life.
Is it hard to sit somewhere in the White House and ask the chief executive these very, very personal questions?
Well, when you've spent, you know, 2.5 years trying to understand everything there is to know about his mother's life, and you have a finite amount of time because, of course, he's president, you are in a state of tunnel vision, and the niceties fall by the wayside. So it was a remarkable experience, but I didn't have trouble asking him the things I wanted to know, and he didn't seem to shy away from answering them.
Tell us a little about his sister, Maya.
Well, she's 9 years younger than him. Her father was Lolo Satoru, and they did not spend a lot of their childhood together. When she was very young, they lived together in Hawaii. He left Indonesia shortly after she was born, in the year after she was born, and then she and her mother joined him in Hawaii for several years while he was in middle school, but then after that, they lived apart. But when he was in Chicago working as a community organizer and she was in the United States, she would go and stay with him during her summer vacations. So I feel they clearly have quite a close relationship. When he was first elected, she and her husband and then her one child, she now is two, moved to Washington for 6 months just to be with him for a while. She is an educator. She just published her first children's book, which actually concerns her mother and an imagined encounter between her mother and her oldest daughter. She is a wonderful, charming person, extremely intelligent and articulate, who I think, you know, had a very, very close relationship with her mother. She was homeschooled to about the age of 12. and lived with her entire childhood, went into the field with her. And she speaks about that in wonderfully evocative language and stories. And her mother died when she was in her early 20s, so I think her loss was a really traumatic moment in her life.
Did they describe her in similar terms, or it sounds like in some ways they had really different experiences with her?
That's my impression, yes. There are similarities in the way they talk about her. They both do talk about how the term they used, or that Maya told me they used to use and that she used, is a softy. And I think they saw the softy side of her that most people didn't. Many of her close friends never saw her cry, whereas her children, I think, saw her weep not infrequently, often in things that related to them. And they also, as I mentioned, seemed to adhere to this idea of her as somewhat naive, which her professional colleagues never saw. They said she was very pragmatic, down to earth, committed, but fully aware of, you know, the corruption, violence, et cetera, of the culture in which she was working. So there are similarities, and yet I do think you're right. And they also both credit very strongly their grandmother in particular for providing a kind of safety net that they say was responsible for their own sense of security as children, that without the safety net that their grandmother provided, who had become a bank vice president, their childhood would have been a lot more destabilizing for them than it was.
It's interesting to think about the parallels between that, and certainly it's not a financial safety net in any way, but the fact that Michelle Obama's mother lives in the White House, and while their parents are traveling, the girls are often in the care of their grandmother.
It goes back further than that. Stanley Dunham, Stanley Ann's father, his mother committed suicide when he was 8, and he was raised by his grandparents. And when Madeline Payne Dunham, Ann's mother, gave birth to Ann, she was working in the Boeing plant in Wichita, and so Ann lived with Madeline's mother. So there's this intergenerational thing going on for generations in that family.
And she did have an inkling, maybe every mother thinks this about her son, but she did have an inkling that he might someday be president?
I agree. Many mothers have that idea about their sons in particular, but I think perhaps she had it more strongly than most. Many people told me that they remembered her talking very proudly and confidently about his potential, saying things like, he's so bright, he could be anything, including president. Several people told me they thought they remembered her saying that either he wanted to be the first black president or she said that he could be the first black president. And then a very man who was very close to her toward the end of her life recalled a conversation they had in which...
Jenny, I'm so sorry I'm going to have to jump in because we are completely out
okay.
of time. The new book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Jenny Scott, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.